The Hoop Heads podcast is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Is this kid coachable? Is he a leader? Does he respect and appreciate authority? Is he a servant of others? Is he the type of teammate that people want to play with? Is he the type of kid that people want to coach? Does he love the game? You know, do you have to twist his arm to come into the gym, or is he knocking on the door waiting for you to open it up? So those are the things that people want to know.
In this very special episode of the Hoopheads podcast, I'll sit down for a wide-ranging conversation with Alan Stein Jr. If you don't know who Alan is, he's a basketball performance coach, he's a court speaker, an author, and a social media influencer. During the interview, Alan shares his knowledge about the player development process, why it takes more than talent to become a great player, his perspective on raising successful kids, how the lessons learned from the game translate to business and life, what youth players can learn from Kobe Bryant, why being present is a skill that we all need to improve, and much, much more. Alan spent 15 years working with the highest performing basketball players in the world, including some of the best ever in the NBA. He shifted his focus about 2 years ago to enter the world of corporate speaking when he realized that the leadership, culture, and teamwork concepts that he was teaching through basketball could be applied in the business world as well. Alan is known for delivering high-energy keynotes and interactive workshops to improve performance, cohesion, and accountability. He inspires and empowers everyone he works with to take immediate action and improve mindset, habits, and productivity. You're going to want to grab your pen and paper so you can take some notes as you enjoy this conversation with Alan Stein, Jr. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here, and we are with a very special guest. For our first interview, we are here with basketball performance coach and corporate speaker Alan Stein. Alan, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. They say you either need to be the first or you need to be the best, so
hopefully you're going
to
be both.
I'm going to do my best to do both.
That's what we're hoping for.
I want to enter the market first. No, I'm excited to be here, man. It's great to finally connect and meet you in person.
Yeah, for sure. Looking forward to it. I know you're speaking at an event tonight that I've been fortunate to be a part of with Authentica. So I'm looking forward to getting you speak in person. I've seen you do a lot of things online with your social media and all the things that you do. And so looking forward to seeing you get up there on stage and perform live.
Awesome, man. Well, get ready. It's going to be a treat.
Awesome. So we're going to start. I'm definitely looking forward to it. So we are going to start. I thought it would be great to kind of go back to the beginning of your basketball journey when you were a kid. And I know I've heard a couple stories about your high school days and playing multiple sports. So just thought we'd start there with what your feelings are about how kids should be playing multiple sports.
Sure. Well, if we go back to the very beginning, I remember in kindergarten signing up and playing on my first team and remember vividly that basketball was my first very strong identifiable passion. I liked a lot of things as a kid, but everything always came back to basketball. I was very thankful that my parents put me in a lot of different sports and activities. I mean, not just your conventional sports of baseball and football and so forth, but I did BMX biking. I was into skateboarding. I was into martial arts. Just about anything that was physically active. I always had a ton of energy. But no matter what I tried, I always kept coming back to basketball. There was something about the game that was remarkable to me. And I think part of the attraction was that I could go out to a court. I mean, this is old school, so we're talking outdoors.
Right, yeah.
And with just a ball and a basket and a little bit of direction, I could work on my own skills and I could work to make myself better. And yet then I could get with a group of guys and play together and we would all have the same goal of winning and we could make each other better. So there was something about the individual aspect that also went with the team aspect that I found really attractive. And then, you know, I'm 42 years old, so while I'm coming up and starting to play basketball is really with the resurgence, you know, the surgence of Michael Jordan and that whole craze of the NBA, you know, basically Larry and Magic passing the torch to Jordan, who, as most people know, I mean, not only changed basketball, but changed pop culture. I mean, basketball was also the cool thing to be doing.
Did you have the shoes?
Of course, every pair. And it was neat. You know, I have, and if we end up talking about parenting, we can go down this rabbit trail. But part of an incentive with my parents was, you know, if I got certain grades, they would buy me Jordans.
Right.
And, you know, I don't necessarily agree with that model now as I'm a parent, but it worked because I wanted Jordans. And it's kind of neat that I can look back now and, you know, as Nike re-releases and these Jordans are coming back, you know, and kids are like, man, those are the dopest shoes ever. I'm like, yeah, I know. I had them in eighth grade. I wore them the first time.
The original, yeah, right. I had the originals.
And I didn't keep them in this pristine case where people could only look at them. I wore them until the tires came off of those things. Like, I played in them out at the park. You know, I remember having the, you know, the Jordan, I think it was the fives. I loved the fives. And those things, I mean, I think my big toe came out of the end of them because I wore them everywhere. But
my favorite were the twos. Because I always thought that they looked kind of like dress shoes.
Yes.
So I told my dad that I was going to get married in them someday.
There you go.
Now, I did not do that. I did not get married in them, but I can definitely relate.
But you could have.
I could have.
And no one would have thought less of you. I certainly could have.
That's it.
Oh, that's too cool. But,
yeah, that's it.
You know, really, I stayed active in a lot of sports. And then when I got to high school, I played soccer. I played varsity soccer as a freshman and played basketball. And then the next year, I decided to give football a try. I had never played football before. So I played football and basketball my sophomore and junior years. And then for my senior year, decided just to play basketball. But, you know, I've always been a huge advocate of kids playing multiple sports and doing a variety of different things. Even if they're better in one sport or they like one sport better, I think that variety, I know for a fact it helps them, you know, it helps them mentally, just to have a break from your sport, just to do something different. But it also helps them physically. It helps reduce, you know, overuse injuries. You know, basketball players, because it's such a running and jumping sport, the repetitive toll that takes on the knees and back and ankle, it's good to do other things. It's good to go out and grass and play soccer, which require different movements on a different surface. And I think those games all help each other. You know, soccer is a game that's all about spacing and moving without the ball. Well, so is basketball. Granted, they're not identical in what you're supposed to do, but the concepts are still the same. So yeah, I'm a huge advocate of players playing multiple sports. But for me, heart always came back to basketball.
And so as you went through your high school career and you looked at the opportunity that you might have to play college basketball, I know I've heard you speak on your recruitment to Elon before and how you recruited yourself to Elon as opposed to them recruiting you. So talk a little bit about your experience being recruited back at the time when you were in high school and then how that translated into your college career.
You know, one thing that's interesting to me is I have such a different perspective on life, as everyone should, when I'm 42 compared to when I was 16, 17, and 18. And I had a very narrow and small view of the world when I was in high school. I thought the fact that I was the best player at my high school meant I was a really, really, really good basketball player. And when you open up the doors and you look at the rest of the world, being the best player at a public school in Montgomery County, Maryland, didn't entitle you to anything. I didn't realize how much better the other players were. And it was even one of those ones that, and I laugh now, you know, even in elementary school age or even in middle school, you know, I would watch a Duke basketball game and it hurts me to even say this now, but I would call the players on the end of the Duke bench scrubs because they didn't play. And that was my view of the world. It didn't dawn on me that the 15th man at Duke was five times better than I was. I didn't grasp that until I became older and started working with players that were the 15th man at Duke and was like, wow, this guy is really good. So part of the concept of I started to get complacent. I started to think, well, yeah, playing college basketball won't be that hard because high school wasn't that hard, and you know, and that's when the reality came of, man, there's some different levels. So Elon was Division II at the time. It was actually Elon College. They're now Elon University, and it was a school that I knew I wanted to go to whether I played a sport or not. And for me, that was the decision that I wanted to make, was I didn't want it to just be about basketball. And I went down and visited the campus and really liked it, but you know, back in the 90s, D2 schools didn't have very big recruiting budgets. Like, a D2 school in North Carolina was not coming to Maryland to watch a player play. So I had to recruit myself to them. And this is still VHS days. So I had to send them a VHS tape of me playing. And thankfully, things worked out, and I got to go down and play at Elon. And depending on how much in depth you want to go there, that journey was pretty neat too, because there have been a couple times in my life where I've gotten bit with the complacency bug. I've thought I'm good enough that I don't need to put the extra work in. And considering that's the exact opposite message now that I get paid to talk about, it's almost like I've lived two lives. There's, you know, the before maturity life and the after maturity life. And, you know, I used to think just going to practice and playing hard was enough. And now I realize that's barely the ante to sit at the table. You got to go in early. You got to stay late. You know, I never put in the extra work outside of practice. So, you know, it's amazing. And I thought that would be good enough. And I take that as a positive now because I have empathy when I see players that have that mindset that I can share with them that, hey, good enough is not good enough. You'd be capable of so much more if you would do more. So my college journey was very up and down. I got to play a lot as a freshman, and that gave me that sense of entitlement. And I had this, you know, feeling that, well, if I'm starting as a freshman, of course I'm going to start for the next 3 years, whoever gets demoted. And it didn't dawn on me that the coach's job is every year to go out and recruit better players than he currently has, which means he's out there looking for players to replace me. And it never dawned on me. And because I was so complacent and I didn't work on my game, that's what happened. They found players that were better and worked harder, and I stopped playing. And when you, as you can appreciate, when you come to that fork in the road, I could have said, you know what? I'm going to earn my minutes back. I'm going to get in the gym, and I'm going to bust my tail and work as hard as possible. That's option one. Or option two is you whine, you complain, you point the finger, and you basically give up. And as embarrassing as it is to say, I chose option B and chose to party and join a fraternity. I still was on the basketball team, and I still did everything I was asked to do, but I never went above and beyond and really didn't play much more for the rest of my career. And I don't want to say it's a regret, because that taught me some important life lessons that I'm able to teach people now. But looking back, yeah, I wish I could go back and slap myself in the face for being so foolish.
So is the best way to teach the kids that you work with when you were in the basketball space, is the best way to teach them those lessons for you just to have that conversation with them? Or what ways did you go about using your experience to help the kids that you worked with?
For me, the biggest message, I look back, what I would say was not matching what I was doing. I would say I want to be a college basketball player, and yet my work ethic and the effort I was putting forth was not congruent with that. I would say I want to start on the college team, but yet I was not going in the gym to get up extra shots. So my behavior and my beliefs were not in alignment. And that's the big thing I teach now is, you know, it's okay for you to say that you don't want to be a great player. There's nothing wrong with that. If you have other interests and basketball is just something you want to do for fun, there is nothing wrong with that. I'm not judging you. However, if you say that you want to be the best player you can be, and you say you want to play in college, then your behavior has to match that. And when I was your age, you know, if I'm speaking to a kid, mine didn't. And that was the result that I got. So if you want to be a great player, then get in early, stay late, do the extra work. Do everything that's required. And once those two things are in alignment, it doesn't guarantee you anything, but it gives you the best chance of that outcome happening. So I do believe, you know, being a starter and an all-county player on one end, and then being the guy that never takes his shooting shirt off on the other, since I've seen both sides, it gives me tremendous empathy and compassion for all different types of players. And I think as a coach, having empathy is important. You know, I like to say that bad attitudes are often understandable, but they're never acceptable. So when I see a kid pouting about not getting playing time, I understand, because I did the same thing. I pouted like a big baby when I didn't get it, but I let him know that that's unacceptable, that the way I acted when I was your age was unacceptable, and if I could do it over again, I would not choose that route. So here's what you can do if you don't like the fact that you're not playing. Talk to your coach. Ask them what you need to do to earn more playing time. Figure out what it is that you're deficient at that you need to get better at in order for them to believe that you'll add value when you're in the game, and work on those things. And I just learned because those were things that I chose not to do when I was that age.
So when did that flip for you? Because in doing a little research on you, I tried to find a story that I hadn't heard before. And I found an article from the Washington Post from the year 2011, and it talked about how you would go out and basically volunteer your services as you were getting into the basketball performance space, and that you actually worked with the State Department. And it was a story how you worked with 10 Iraqis children that had come over, and you had some relationship with the State Department, and you were obviously, these were not kids who were going to end up as college players or NBA players. And you put yourself out there, and obviously your work ethic flipped where you were going out and doing these things for free to build your business, which, listening to your previous story as a player, you were looking for something to be given to you, and here in the business world, you obviously were not. So I'm assuming that that flipped. So talk a little bit about that, and then also just share the story of working with those, with the State Department, those Iraqi children.
You know, as I mentioned, I lived a very sheltered life growing up. You know, I lived in a two-parent household, middle class. It was a primarily white suburban area, and it didn't dawn on me that there were areas, not only in the world, but even in our country, that were poverty-stricken, that there were kids that didn't get Jordans because they got good grades. Like, I was never exposed to any of that. So I had no idea that there was other ways that folks were living. And once I went through college and I started having some of these other experiences and the world started to open up, yeah, then I started to have a grave appreciation for these different groups. And, you know, like the Iraqi kids that you were mentioning, you know, just for them to play basketball was a huge privilege, and they loved to play. So regardless of the level they could play, they had so much love and passion just for the game, and that's what really reignited my fire. And yeah, I would say it took me a few years after college to really shake that entitled mentality and flip that over and say, I have to earn everything. Nothing, you know, and that's one of the reasons I actually like that I've been an entrepreneur my entire life. I've never had a corporate or conventional job, is because now I realize that my success, my significance, my happiness, my fulfillment, all of that stuff is 100% up to me, and all of those things have to be earned. None of that stuff will be given to me. And that's been a really neat experience. And so, yeah, thankfully I got my head on straight rather early and realized that, hey, you have to prove your worth in everything that you do. If you want the ability to work at Montrose Christian or DeMatha or do stuff for Nike, you have to earn it. And you have to prove to people that you can add value to what they're doing. So once I kind of snapped out of that mentality that the world owes me something, and I started saying being a servant leader and seeing how I can help others is a much better way to approach life. Not just because of what you'll get out of it, it's a lot more fulfilling. When you're pouring into other people and filling other people's buckets, it's a lot more rewarding than when you sit back with your arms crossed with a handout expecting people to give you stuff. And, you know, that's really what flipped it. And that's really how I got my start in basketball. And then 15 years later, when I make the leap over to the corporate side, I really had that mindset down and said, you know what, I know how to attack this thing now. I know how to build it brick by brick, and I know how to earn people's trust by showing them that I can add value to their life.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go back a couple steps here for players that might be listening.
Mm-hmm.
I heard you talk about your pyramid that you work with Drew Hanlon from Pure Sweat on, where you have the body as the base, and the skill, and then the IQ, and finally the thing that we can't really have an impact on, which is the heart of the player. So can you talk about each one of those slices of the pyramid and how that impacts players from all the way up from the NBA all the way down to the youth level?
Yeah. Well, a player is a player, and the skills of the game will never change. Whether you're 8 years old or you're LeBron James, the game is predicated on passing, rebounding, defending, handling the ball. You know, those are the skills of the game. And then when you mix that with the IQ and the understanding of how to play, and then you take the intangibles about caring about your teammate, all of those things create the perfect storm to be the best player you can be. But if we really break it down, it always starts with the body. Because if you can't run and jump and move, or worse, if you're hurt, then you can't play the game anyway. So the body is incredibly important, which is the other reason that I really want kids to play multiple sports, because it works on their body in a variety of different ways. It works different muscle groups and different movement patterns, and that stuff is so important. So a player improving the way they move and their athleticism is the foundation. Now, once we go above that, now you actually have to work on the skills of the game, because it doesn't matter how athletic you are. If you can't put the ball in the basket or stop the other guy from doing the same, then you're not going to be a very good basketball player. You'll just be a great athlete. So working on the fundamentals and the skills. So it's not just being able to make a bounce pass. You also have to know when and how to use that type of bounce pass. And that's what leads us to the mind, which is the IQ, which is the grit, the mental fortitude. But do you know how to play the game? Because if you're incredibly athletic and you're incredibly skilled, but you have no idea how to use your athleticism or how to use your skill, it will limit you as a player. And then that's what takes us to the top, which is the motor, which is the heart, is the passion. How much do you love the game? If you truly love the game, then you can maximize the other three areas, even if they're not elite. I mean, I've been around kids with average athleticism, average skill, pretty good understanding of the game, and they've been able to overachieve because of their heart and because of their motor. And I do believe that to play at the highest level in the NBA, to be world class, I mean, you've got to be pretty good in all four. I mean, yes, there'll be a player that comes around that's not particularly athletic, but their IQ and their fundamentals and their heart are so sound, it can compensate a little bit. We've also seen some players that maybe don't have the highest IQ, but, you know, their athleticism and their skill is off the charts. And then, of course, we've all seen players who had unbelievable athleticism, tremendous skill and IQ, but they just didn't love to play and they didn't care, and those players always fizzle out. They'll never make it, because in order to be successful in anything, you got to be all in. And the only way you can be all in is if you love it. So, yeah, I do. I believe that pyramid is true for LeBron James, who clearly maxes out all four categories, as it is for a young player. And, you know, with a player like LeBron, because he's so athletic, people take for granted how high his basketball IQ is. They take for granted how fundamentally sound he is. He makes things look so easy that they forget that he's playing so hard. Sometimes it looks like he's coasting because he's so efficient. You know, he doesn't have to make scowling faces because he's sucking wind, because he's in such good shape that he's at that level. So often we can get blinded when someone is so elite in one area. But a guy like LeBron, I mean, he's 10 for 10 in all four.
So you've had an opportunity to work with guys through your work with Nike and at DeMatha and at Montrose, with guys who have reached the highest level, whether it's Kobe Bryant or LeBron or Durant. I know you've told the story about Steve Nash. And I know you've told the Kobe story numerous times, but I'd like you to
just
kind of
hear it again tonight.
I would just
love giving you a heads up.
All right. Well, I would love
that's
to hear
my go-to, baby.
I would love for our audience to be able to hear that story, because I want to piggyback on something that relates down to the level of player when we're talking about a kid who's 7 or 8 years old. I think we can take this story and we can bring it down to a level where it makes sense for kids who are trying to make themselves a better player when they hear the story that you're about to tell with Kobe.
Well, I'm going to give you the abbreviated version, because I know that story has been out there, and I can't afford to have it wear out its welcome, because I'm telling you, man, it's where I hang my hat. Other than this pretty face, that's the one that's getting me paid right now. So, no, I had a chance to watch Kobe do a private workout back in 2007, and aside from being shocked at how early he liked to work out, the part that blew my mind was, you know, here he is, the best player in the world, and I was thinking he was going to be doing all these fancy drills with flash and sizzle, and he was doing such basic stuff. Now, it's Kobe Bryant, so of course everything he's doing was at an unparalleled level of effort, with tremendous focus, with razor-sharp precision, but the stuff he was doing was very basic. It's probably a lot of the same stuff you do with the players that you work with. And I remember being so blown away by that until he brought me back down to earth and said the reason he's so good is because he doesn't get bored with the basics. And that, I mean, it was a life-changing lesson for me, that the basics, yes, they're often boring, they're often mundane, but falling in love with the basics and committing to those is always going to be the foundation to which everything else is built. And if you want to be able to do, say, a fancier move or a more advanced move, you can only progress to that level once you've mastered the levels underneath it. So if you can't do very basic moves and very basic footwork, then please don't try to emulate your favorite NBA player when they do some type of reverse turnaround fadeaway. Like, if you're a kid and you jump to that, that's basically disrespecting the process and disrespecting the fact that that player has spent years, often decades, mastering the basics before they even attempt to do something like that. And, you know, although he's one of the few players I never had a chance to meet, I've always loved Tim Duncan, you know, the big fundamental, about a guy who just mastered the basics over and over and is arguably the greatest power forward to ever play the game, you know. But if you turn on SportsCenter, you never saw many Tim Duncan highlights, you know, other than holding up a trophy at the end of the year because they won it. But that's a guy that was so committed to doing things right and not worrying about flash, and look how successful he was. And the hard part is, and we all fall victim to this, we live in a society that promotes flash, that promotes sizzle, that wants, you know, to put on the Instagram the latest and-one mixtape of breaking people's ankles instead of doing the fundamental moves that will get you the result that you want.
Yeah, for sure. I know that one of the challenges that I face when we're at basketball camp or I'm doing training with especially a young kid, and we'll start out, we'll work on just a basic front pivot or a reverse pivot or a rip through, or we're doing form shooting with one hand. And I can see if I've worked with the kid a couple of times, we get to the third or fourth time that I've worked with them, and we start out with those same basic drills, and I can see on the kid's face, coach, why are we still doing this? Why aren't we moving on to, why can't I go between my legs? Why can't I get a double move? Why can't I do all these different things? And that's one of the things as a coach, that to hear you relay that story about somebody who at the time was the best player in the world, that here they are working on very simple drills that you might have done with the kid who was in seventh grade at that same time, just makes me feel good that I know we're on the right path with what we're trying to do and what we're trying to teach kids. So hopefully, if you're a parent or you're a child out there and you're listening, you're getting the message that the basics and those fundamentals are so critically important
for sure
to your development as a player.
Well, let me say this, because you absolutely are on the right track. Here's where I think a lot of people get confused. They think the word basic and the word easy are synonyms, and they're not. Just because something is basic in theory doesn't mean that it's easy to do. In fact, to do basic movements like footwork and pivoting and some of these basic moves, to have the fortitude and the focus to be able to do those relentlessly for hours on end, days, weeks, months, years, and in many cases decades, is not easy to do. If it was easy, everyone else would be doing that. That stuff is incredibly hard. So we can't confuse basic with easy. And that was really the lesson that I pulled out of that. And now I will say this, having worked with kids for a long time, just like you do, part of being a good coach is making sure, and I know you know this, is getting believe in and getting buy-in. So we also have to meet the players a little bit in the middle, which means if I'm going to do a 60-minute workout, 50 minutes of that are going to be based on the fundamentals, the basics, the things they need to do to get better. The other 10 minutes will be some of the sizzle. It'll be some things that I know they want to do, because that's the cherry on top that will keep them coming back. Because at the end of the day, excuse me, if I take the mindset that it's my way or the highway, in today's day and age, most kids will take the highway. And my ultimate goal of helping them develop and be the best player they can be, I'm not going to accomplish my goal because they're not going to come back to see me. So, yes, we're going to work on footwork and form shooting, but then at the very end, we can play horse. Or at the very end, let's see who can make the first half-court shot. Or at the very end, you know, I would do that with some hand-eye coordination stuff, and I would give them a minute, because I don't do skill work, I just did performance work, but I would let them do some ball handling stuff and just have fun with it. And I would say, hey, you know, this is not stuff your coach wants you working on. This is not stuff you're going to do in a game. But I was a kid once, and this was the same stuff I did in my driveway. See how many times I could go behind my back or do the spider drill or whatever. So knock yourself out.
Right.
So I think as a coach, we have to meet them in the middle and let them do some things they want. But they're still getting 50 minutes of really good instruction. And if the last 10 minutes are a little bit of a fluff session, that's okay.
Right, and the game still has to be fun.
Of course.
Ultimately, we all have to remember that it's a
yeah.
game. It's a game, despite the fact that you know, it can be serious business at times for all of us.
For sure.
It's still a fun game that we all loved when we were 5, 6, 7 years old. It's what we talked about at the very beginning.
Yes.
Why you fell in love with it.
And it's always important to put it into context. I have zero problem with the kid going out and dribbling between their legs 52 times when they're working out, as long as they know that they should not do that in a game. There's a difference. You know, when they're practicing, I want them to use their imagination. I want them to challenge themselves and have some creativity. I want them to practice doing some fun stuff. As long as they know that that's not an endorsement to get in the game and dribble 52 times between your legs when 6 of your teammates are open, then yeah, as long as they know that, then I'm cool with that. As soon as that starts to affect the way they play, then that would be a problem. But I, you know, if a kid wants to jack up a couple of half-court shots before he leaves, knock yourself out, man. Have fun being a kid.
Let's go with one more basketball-related question.
Sure.
I know you wrote an article, it's probably been a couple of years, called Everything Matters, where you talked about the fact that it's not just your basketball skill when a college is looking at a player, or when an NBA is scouting, when the NBA teams are scouting players. It's not just their basketball skill. It's also these ancillary things that, if we talk about, I know you're a big believer in learning life lessons through basketball, and so I'm a believer in that same thing. And so talk about how NBA people would come to you and ask questions about players, and what the types of questions were that they were asking, and how that impacts the way that you interact with kids.
Well, as a performance coach, my job was to improve athleticism, the old added, you know, get them bigger, faster, stronger. So when college coaches would come and ask, or NBA personnel would come back and ask, it was always remarkable to me that they never asked anything about performance or athleticism. Everything they asked about were the intangibles, their character, their leadership. Were they a good teammate? You know, even to the degree of some of them would say something to the effect of, would you let this young man date your daughter? Like, do you think enough of him as a human that you would let him date your daughter? Because to them, that answer will speak way more than what is their vertical jump. You know, most of that stuff they can see. They can see it with their eyes, or they can see it on film. But do they? Is this kid coachable? Is he a leader? Does he respect and appreciate authority? Is he a servant of others? Is he the type of teammate that people want to play with? Is he the type of kid that people want to coach? Does he love the game? You know, do you have to twist his arm to come into the gym, or is he knocking on the door waiting for you to open it up? So those are the things that people want to know. And I think there's a good reason for that. The game has grown so much that there are so many talented players today that college programs and NBA teams don't have to take a risk on getting a jerk. Because there's enough good kids that are also good players. And, you know, maybe 30 years ago you needed to take that risk because there weren't as many good players. And we all know, I mean, let's admit the elephant in the room. Talent wins. Like, you have to have talented players. No one is saying that you're going to give a full scholarship to a kid that couldn't play dead in a cowboy movie, but he just happens to be a nice kid. We're not saying that. The level playing field is all of these kids can play at a high level. But if they can all play, then let's get good character kids. Let's get kids that are going to do the academic work, that are good teammates, that you don't have to worry about getting in trouble. Kids that make good decisions on a regular basis. And when they make a poor decision, they own it and they learn from it. So those were always the questions I would get. And, you know, and anytime the most talented kid was also one of the best kids, those are the ones that are incredibly successful.
And so that leads us into a whole new category of questions, which is parenting.
Yes.
You're the parent of three kids. You have twin boys and then a daughter. How old are your kids now?
So Luke and Jack are 8 going into third grade, and my daughter Lila is 6 going into first.
All right. So I've read a bunch of different things that you've written that can be applicable not just to business or basketball, but also to parenting. And I know one of the biggest things that you've espoused, especially recently, is your saying of be where your feet are. Can you explain how that relates to those of us who are parents, how we can be more engaged with our kids?
As you probably guessed, I love what I do. I'm so thankful for everything that the game has afforded me, and I'm loving this new chapter of being in the corporate world. And sometimes my passion for those things drowns out the fact that being a father is actually what's most important to me. That's the hat that I'm proudest to wear. And to me, ultimately, that's kind of going to be my legacy. Did I help raise three good people that were well-adjusted and are going to contribute to society when they're older? To me, that will be far more important than any camps I've worked or any companies I've spoken to. And that's not to diminish those areas, because those things are important to me, but being a parent is incredibly important. And, you know, like any parent listening to this, there's not been a handbook that's been given to any of us. This is all stuff we're trying to figure out on the fly. I'm actually thankful that I waited till later in life to have kids, because as I've already talked about in this podcast, in my earlier years, I didn't know up from down. I thought I did, but I didn't. And boy, if I would have had kids in my 20s, I would have been a train wreck as a father. And I'm thankful now that I certainly make plenty of parenting mistakes. I think I'm doing a better job. And you referenced the be where your feet are, which is just another way of saying live in the present moment. And that's important for a couple reasons. One, for me as a father, I want to be present with my children. I want to give them my undivided attention, because I believe that's the number one currency we can give anyone. And when you give someone your attention, it shows them that you care, and it shows them that they're important to you. And obviously, I want my children to know that. Every parent does, but I say this with respect and with grace and compassion, not every parent's behavior shows their kids that they're the most important thing. They talk about it, and I know that they know it in their heart, but their behavior is not in alignment. So giving my kids my full attention to the best of my ability, I get distracted just like every other person listening to this, but the ability to be present with them makes for a more connected and fulfilling relationship with each other, but it also models that behavior. And you know, as a parent, just like as a coach, what we model is way more important than what we say. I can tell my kids to be respectful, But if I want them to know how important it is to be respectful, I'm going to be polite to the waitress when she brings me a water and say please and thank you. So I'm going to model respect, because that's going to trump just talking about it. So same thing. If I want my children to learn how to be present in an incredibly distracted world, then I have to model that for them. And like anything else, I have good days and I have bad days. And because I'm amicably divorced, so I might be in a different situation since some of the parents listening, I don't have my kids full time. I have them half the time. And when I'm dropping them off at their mom's house, I always do a quick run through and I grade myself. And I'm like, Alan, how good of, on a scale of 1 to 10, how good of a father were you today? Were you present, or were you distracted by the talk you have to give tomorrow? Were you patient and compassionate, or were you a little bit on edge and short-tempered because you were in a bad mood? And, you know, some nights I drive home and think someone should send me a Father of the Year trophy, and other nights I drive home and think, man, I wish I had a do-over. I wish there was a mulligan for this, because I did not do the best job I'm capable of. But thankfully, I've gotten to a point where when I drive home on the nights where I admit that I wasn't as good as I was capable of, I learn from it, I flush it, and I just make sure that the next time I see my children, I do a better job. I don't beat myself up over it, because it's in the past. And, you know, I preach to players, hey, when you turn the ball over, it's over. Don't pout about it. Run back on defense and let's get it back on the other end. You can't change it. I want you to learn from it, you know, especially if you made a poor decision with that turnover, but you can't change it. And it's the same thing with my kids. I'm not a perfect parent by any means, but I think I now have the awareness to know what I need to do to be a great father, and I'm working towards that every day.
So what I hear you saying is that you're self-aware of what you're doing. And I think that's one of the things that no matter what we're talking about, whether it's parenting, basketball, the business world, that people who are self-aware and reflective of what they're doing tend to be more successful. Can you talk a little bit about being self-aware, how that's helped you in all the spaces that you've been in?
Yeah, well, I appreciate you saying that, and that's one of the best compliments I would ever like to get as someone that believes that I'm self-aware. A few things. One, I don't think self-aware is a destination. I think it's a constant process. Sitting here right now, I believe I have a fairly decent amount of self-awareness, but if I stop working at it, that will disappear. I'm not a golfer, but I think it's a lot like golf. Like, golf is not a sport that anyone masters. It's, you know, even the best in the world, they're still going to hit a bad shot every now and then. They're still going to have a bad round. Or, you know, the reason they're the best in the world is they very rarely hit bad shots, and they very rarely have bad rounds. And when they do hit a bad shot, they flush it, and their next shot makes up for it, and they get back on track. So I think the same thing with self-awareness. You can't really stick a flag in the ground and say, hey, everyone, I'm self-aware. This game is over. This will be something I'll be working on for the rest of my life. And, you know, I've already told you kind of the two stories of my life: the immature, entitled Alan in his basically all the way up probably to 25, and then the hopefully more mature with the mindset of earning. Well, I'll say from a self-awareness standpoint, I probably spent 36, 37 years rather unaware. And then as I was going through my divorce and I started to go through some counseling and some therapy, that's where the self-awareness really came out. So I'd like to think now, for the past 4 to 5 years, I've been on a much more aware journey. And here's what's interesting about self-awareness. You often have to step outside of yourself to get self-awareness. And I know that sounds counterintuitive, but it's easy for any of us to be blinded by our blind spots and not realize certain things. And a perfect example, I was never a very good listener. Not that I disrespected authority, I was always too busy thinking of what I wanted to say to really listen to what other people had to say. And that's not a great trait when you're trying to build connection with people. And it's definitely not a good trait for a coach. But I've become a much better active listener over the years. And a lot of that I give credit to the therapy that I went through. I had a therapist that basically told me the stuff that I needed to hear, not the stuff I wanted to hear. And they were things like, well, you don't listen very well. You're not very aware. And of course, I didn't want to have anything to do with it at first.
Like, I don't want to hear that advice.
Yes, exactly.
Tell me something else.
I mean, as comical as that is, that was kind of my approach. But thankfully, I put my faith in her and I let my guard down and started to work on those things. And that's a perfect example. If right now, Mike, if you say that you're an expert at active listening, and I talk to the 5 people that know you the best, and they all tell me you're one of the worst active listeners, guess what? You're not. Your self-awareness radar is way off. So there's a difference between being self-aware and being accurate. And often we need to get that self-awareness by going to the people that know us the best, the people that love us, they trust us, they support us, they hold us accountable, and getting their opinion of these things to help us alleviate some of these blind spots. So going through that and then starting that journey of really learning self-awareness. And here's the other thing about self-awareness. Most of us are very aware of the things that we like and the things that we're good at. Because who doesn't want to be aware of that stuff? Most people aren't willing to go to the depths of what they're not good at, of what scares them, of what they're insecure about, you know, their fears, their dislikes, you know, and really dig deep. Because when you, all of us have insecurities. All of us have fears. All of us have some of these toxic emotions in us. And being able to look those dead in the eye and face those is what I believe self-awareness is. And you will come out stronger on the other end because you'll be more vulnerable. And, you know, I can tell you right now to a T the things that I do really well. I can also tell you to a T the things that I don't do well. I can tell you to a T the things that drive me, motivate me, and get me excited. I can still tell you things that scare me and that I'm insecure about. And being able to face those things has been rather liberating. Most people are scared of them, but it's incredibly liberating because it's, you know, I know this will sound really weird, but I'm going to make an 8 Mile reference with Eminem. If you remember the last battle scene, he won that rap battle because he basically admitted all of the stuff about him that he knew the other guy was going to say, and he took the power back by admitting his weaknesses and his downfalls and the things the other guy could make fun of him for. He now had the power. And that's how I look at self-awareness. I'm in the driver's seat of myself and my life because I'm willing to admit everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And I think when you do that, especially with your kids, you have a much more honest relationship with your kids because they see you and that ability to be vulnerable and the ability to say that, hey, I'm not perfect. I do make mistakes. There are things that I can improve on. And when you allow yourself to be open that way with kids, they respond to that very well. And I think they're much more open to being able to do that. One of the last things I want to touch on with you with parenting is you've talked about comparison and running your own race and not looking around at what the people are next to you are doing. And I know that's one of the things that not just as parents and kids, but just as a society in general, everybody tends to look at. What does the person over here have? What does this person have? What are they getting to do that I'm not getting to do? And so talk a little bit about how you talk to your kids about running their own race, staying in their lane, and making sure that they're focused on what they can do and not what somebody next to them has.
For sure. Before I touch on that, though, just think as a basketball player how important it is for a basketball player to be aware of their game. Like most of the players that are jacking up threes have no business shooting threes, but they don't have the awareness to know that they're not a very good shooter.
Because they're 1 for 20 in practice? What are you talking about?
So they don't have an awareness. Yeah, they know what things they're good at. They know what their favorite move is, but they don't know where the holes in their game are. They don't know that when they get scouted by a really good team that those things are going to get taken away. So having an awareness as a player, as a parent, as a business owner, as a coach, or just as a human being is incredibly important. I've been on so many different shows. You have done a tremendous job thoroughly researching this, and I love the stuff that you're teeing up. This is no joke, not just because you're sitting here. This is one of my favorite interviews that I've done. You've really done a great job.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
And the comparison game thing is a trap that I think is easy for any of us to fall into, and I've fallen into it many times. But playing the comparison game is not one you can win, ever. Because no matter what, if you're using external metrics, you will always find someone that is better than you in a certain area, and it's just not worth playing. So you have to learn how to run your race and, you know, focus more on what you do. You know, focus on your attitude and your effort and your preparation and your enthusiasm. I mean, this is an old John Woodenism. Don't worry about them. Let them worry about you. And I think that's a good mindset to have. You know, the comparison game that many parents fall into, first of all, for ourselves, you worry about how much money you're making and where you live and what kind of house and what kind of car. And why are we worried about any of that stuff? Because we're worried what other people think. We're worried about comparing it to someone else. You know, I'm a speaker. Well, how much does this guy charge? He's charging more than me. What? Who cares? Don't worry about any of that stuff. And it's much easier said than it is done. So I find myself often falling down that trap of playing the comparison game, but now because I have some self-awareness, I can snap myself out of it quickly. But when it comes to parenting, you know, many parents that I've seen make decisions for their own children based on the comparison game and what everyone else is going to think. Well, I want you to get good grades because I want you to go to a good college. Well, why do you want them to go to a good college? So you can tell all of your friends that my kid goes to Harvard? Or is it because you really want them to go to Harvard? More times than not, if you dig deep, the real meaning is so they can tell everyone, my kid's going to Harvard, which is clearly a reflection of what an amazing parent I am. So everyone should be bowing down to me because my kid goes to Harvard. And I have very different metrics for me. You know, it's funny because my daughter Lila mocks me and she does a great job. The number one skill set I want for my children to have is the ability to make good decisions. Like, that's the number one skill set. Whether it's in their social life, their academic life, their athletic life, if you constantly make good decisions, you will have a good life. If you make great decisions, you will have a great life. And of course, none of us are immune to making bonehead decisions, but it's a consistency thing. So I try to teach my children to make good decisions, which means when my children graduate from high school, if in their mind the best decision for them is not even to go to college, it's to pursue something else, I am 100% fine with that. I want them to learn how to take ownership and make good decisions. Certainly, I'm big on respect and character. You know, I don't have a lot of rules with my children. You know, I don't believe in a lot of rules. I believe that if you make good decisions and you are respectful and you serve others and you're a good person, almost everything else falls into place. And I know I'm speaking a little bit prematurely because I'm not there yet. And I would, you know, but when my kids are older, like, I'm not too worried about having a curfew with my kids because I'm hoping I've gotten to a point where they're going to make good decisions. And if they think staying out till 3 a.m. is a good decision, I think they'll learn pretty soon that it's not. There are consequences to staying out till 3 a.m. But I want them to learn those things. So I try not to confine my children with a lot of rules, but rather empower them to make good decisions. And, you know, when you play the comparison game, I have chats with parents all the time and they think I'm absolutely out of my mind, that I'm not worried about where they go to college. I'm not worried about any of those things. I don't even tell my kids that they have to do their homework. That drives parents insane. But here's what it is. If you choose not to do your homework, there will be a consequence for that. And let's say the consequence is a bad grade. Well, if you get enough bad grades, you're not going to be eligible to play a sport. So if playing sports is really important to you, then you making the choice not to do your homework is a bad one. And you will learn that. And I don't need to be the one to tell you that. You will learn that the good old-fashioned way through the school of hard knocks. And so that's just my own parental philosophy. I'm not saying this because I want anyone else to adopt my philosophies. That's just the way that I believe in empowering my children. And it all comes back to the comparison game. So, you know, funny enough, I mean, I love sports. I'm an intense guy. I'm a competitive guy. I hate to lose. And yet when my kids are playing sports, I'm silent. I'm a step away from being a mime. Like, I don't say a word because I just want them to have their experience. And since you're so well researched, you've probably seen that the only thing I ask of my kids when they play sports is to listen to
the coach. I stole this from you. Go ahead.
Well, I'm thankful, say it. I want you to.
I definitely stole it from you. I use this all the time, so please share.
But I'm hoping, and that's why it's neat to do things that are recorded, because if I ever step out of this, I want you to send me this in 5 years and replay it. Because even when my kids are in high school, what's most important is you listen to your coach, you be a good teammate, you have fun, and you play as hard as you can. And I believe if you do those four things, everything else will take care of itself. If you're listening to your coach and they're correcting your footwork, you will improve. If you care just as much about the guy to your right or left as you care about yourself, good things will happen to you. If you're having fun, then I know you're going to give a good effort. And as soon as you're not having fun, it's okay. Don't feel any pressure from me to keep playing. Now, the rule with my children is once they sign up to start a season, they have to finish that season. I don't allow them to quit midway. But my son Luke signed up for baseball, finished the entire season, and said, I don't like baseball. And I said, you don't ever have to play baseball again for the rest of your life. You finished your commitment, and now it's your choice. And I believe in that. And then, of course, effort. I want my kids to give a good effort because, especially if they're on a team sport, other people are counting on them to give a good effort. So, you know, it's like that old cliche that all of us coaches talk about. It's trading the me for we. And when you sign up to be a part of something bigger than yourself, you owe it to the people next to you to give your best effort. This ain't about you anymore. It's about them. So those are the things that are most important to me. And, I mean, really, I could change the language a little bit. It'd be the same thing when you go to a job, you know. Be coachable with the folks that you work with. Be good to your coworkers and to your clients, you know. Love what you're doing because that will make what you're doing infectious, and give your best effort. So these things, you know, are fairly simple, but as we said earlier with the Kobe story, They're not easy to do. But back to the comparison game, when parents start talking about, you know, their kids specializing in a sport and playing on 19 travel teams because their kid's going to go to this school and do this, I just exit the conversation because I'm not worried about any of that. And the only thing, and I don't really care about people judging me, but if my kids grow up to make good decisions, they're servant leaders, they add value to this world, they always do what's right, they help people that are less fortunate, like they do those types of things, then if someone wants to make the comparison game there because their kid went to Harvard, let's line them up.
Exactly.
Let's line them up.
Exactly. So let's make one final transition here, Alan.
Sure.
All the things that you've learned. So we've gone through a ton of things that you've gained experience from. Now you've made a shift. You're in the corporate world. You're speaking to Fortune 500 companies. You're speaking to people who have had success in other walks of life besides basketball. How does all the things that you've done up to this point in your life lead you into the decision to go into corporate speaking? And what is it that has energized you and that you love about what you're doing now?
There's a few things. It was a little bit of a tough decision to kind of leave the basketball space because, as you've probably heard here, I have a strong passion for not only basketball but for pouring into young people. Like, being a role model and helping kids has always been something that's important to me. And serving coaches has been equally important. You know, I think I take a lot of pride in the coaching fraternity, and that includes women coaches as well. It just sounds awkward saying fraternity and sorority. But any coach that is willing to give of their time to pour into young people, I got your back. Like, you're the type of person that I love, and I want that. But I found that after 15 years of just pouring into coaches and pouring into players, I was ready for a different audience. I was ready for a new challenge. You know, most of what people wanted me to do in the basketball space was on the athleticism side, was improve, you know, footwork and movement. But most of what I was stimulated by was leadership and accountability and culture. So for me, it was a transition of, I needed a new challenge. I needed to go somewhere that would stretch me and push me. So I needed to enter an arena where now I was the rookie. You know, I already told you, I've never had a corporate job in my life. So now every time I go speak to an organization, whether it's in the pre-event call when I'm learning as much about them as possible, I'm learning so much. Now, I'm not saying that I wasn't learning when I was working with coaches and players, but I had started to max out my interest level in those specific domains. And, you know, as most people can appreciate that are listening to this, and I say this with due respect, you know, if you spend all of your time around 15 to 18 year old boys, they only think about a couple things, basketball, and you can probably guess what the other one is. So it wasn't stimulating me intellectually. I loved being a role model and I loved pouring into them, but I just needed something else. And that was why I decided to make this leap. And, you know, I've always enjoyed speaking. So I love being in front of people. And I also wanted the challenge of, man, can I take all of these life lessons that I learned through the game, that I learned some of them by myself the hard way, some of them that I've learned from some amazing colleagues and friends, can I make them translate into another area that can benefit people? And it's been a blast kind of figuring out and you know, finalizing that Rubik's Cube. And it's been very well received so far. I know that I'm not for everyone, but the people that are in my tribe in the corporate world that love the sports analogy, if you will, it's been amazing and it's been resonating, and I'm feeling a connection with people and I'm learning so much. I mean, and for me, I'm happiest when I'm growing and I'm learning. And I just started to get burnt out on what's the latest exercise to get a player stronger. That just didn't excite me the way, how can I get this player to be a better teammate? How can I get you to be a better servant leader at your business? If you're having some cultural issues with your company, how can we rectify that and fix that so you guys can make more money and serve more people? That's what got me excited. So on one hand, as much as I believe in serving others, it was a little bit of a selfish move because I wanted something that really challenged me and motivated me.
All right, and then you have a book coming out.
I do.
January?
January, yes.
All right. So tell us a little bit about your book. Do a little sales pitch for the book before we get out of here and let people know what's coming on the horizon for you with the book.
You're so kind. You don't have to tell me twice to promote myself. I'm the second coming of Don King. Like, I got no problem with self-promotion.
Bring it, Alan. Bring it.
Well, the book's called Raise Your Game, and really I've always, it was kind of a passion project. And that proverbial bucket list that most people have, I've always had on my bucket list that I wanted to write a book. And I felt this was the time to do it. You know, I'm so thankful to have been around so many great players and so many great coaches that have poured into me and have taught me things and showed me things behind the curtain. I almost felt obligated to share those things with other people, people that weren't privy to be able to work with some of the people I was able to work with, and I wanted to do that. It also was incredibly helpful because it forced me to curate all of my material, all of my content, all of my stories, all of my life lessons, and boy, was that a lot of fun because I would dust off some of the cobwebs and go, oh man, I remember this thing that a coach taught me at Five Star 20 years ago. Boy, that's a lesson that other people need to hear. So curating everything was fun, and it's helped with the speaking because now it allowed me to organize all of my content in a way that I can present it so that it's adding value to others. But I tell you what, being a team guy and also having the humility of knowing what I'm good at and what I'm not, I hired a co-author because I know that sitting down and writing a book is not my strong point. Curating content, creating content, storytelling, and life lessons, that's what I'm pretty good at. So I got someone that I worked with, and he was the consummate teammate. He was the one that kind of organized that stuff and put them in the right silos and then would say, hey, Alan, you know, the chapter on team cohesion is a little bit thin. Can you give me a couple of stories? And I would just sit down for a night and think back, and the next day I'd have seven stories of my journey. And so doing that was a lot of fun. So the book, it's by Alan Stein with John Sternfeld, it was a team effort, and that's most of what I preach and talk about now. So I think the book, yeah, I'm excited. You know, talking about process versus outcome, all I could control was the quality of the book, and I'm very proud to say that that is the best book that I was capable of putting out at the time. Now, 10 years from now, hopefully I could write a better book, but it's the best book I could do. I don't control who's going to buy it. I don't control whether or not I make a dollar off of it. I don't control whether or not it makes the bestseller list. So I've learned to not worry about those things. I've done my part, which is create the best book possible. And I'm hoping that when people read it, they enjoy it and want to share it with other people that they think it will impact. And if that's the case, then those outcomes will take care of themselves. I don't have to worry about them. And that's also, I'm making it sound really easy. I'd be lying to you right now if I said I don't want it to be a New York Times bestseller. Of course I want it to. But I don't have any control over that, and I'm not going to lose an ounce of sleep if I don't. But I just wanted to put out some good work, and I'm excited for it and proud, and folks will be hearing about it this fall because I've got to promote it a little bit. Because I'm not promoting it for reasons of trying to make money or do this. I'm promoting it because I believe in what I wrote, and I think folks that read it will benefit from it, and I want to as many people to benefit as possible. That's what being a coach is all about. You know, any good coach will tell you, they don't just coach the 15 players on their team. They coach anybody they come in contact with to help them live a better life. And that's another reason why I've always been so attracted to coaches. So, yeah, if you're listening, it's just the book's called Raise Your Game, Performance Secrets from the Best of the Best. You can get it for pre-order now on Amazon, but it will be ready in January. And, yeah, and if anybody will buy 25,000 copies, that would drastically help.
That'll get you towards the New York Times bestseller list right there. Yeah,
yes, it will. Well, I'll even give you one of my children if you buy 25,000 copies.
The offer's out there, people. The offer is out there. 25,000 copies, free child for you. Again, I think anybody who's listened to Alan and I's conversation here for the last little bit, and if you've heard Alan on any of the other things that he's done, or you've seen him on the internet, or you've been fortunate enough to hear him speak, I can't see why you wouldn't want to pick up his book and continue to learn some of the things that he's put out there for everybody. So Alan, this has been awesome. I appreciate you taking the time, stopping by when you're here in Cleveland. I know you have your big event tonight. I'm looking forward to sitting out in the audience and hearing you speak in person for the first time. It's been great. Can you tell everybody just how they can get in contact with you before we get out of here?
Sure. Well, you know, I have no idea who you're going to have as your next guest, but boy, do I feel bad for whoever that person is, because these are some colossal shoes to fill. So I don't know. You better find somebody good that can.
All right, I'm on it.
Yeah, I'm pretty easy to find. Just alansteinjr.com is the website, and I'm at Alan Stein Jr. on all the major social channels. And I love engaging with folks. If anything that Mike and I talked about resonated with you, you know, shoot me a tweet, shoot me an email, whatever. And I appreciate it. And again, I'm not kidding, man. This was a real delight. You really did your homework, and I'm very thankful for that.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on and giving us the time. And to all of you out there, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on our next episode.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have 4 different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com. Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, brought to you by Head Start Basketball.